From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. One of the most successful phylums of life on Earth is a creature that very few of us have spent much time considering at all. Nematodes are also known as roundworms, and if you happen to be a potato farmer, you might also know these little things as eelworms. They are very small and often microscopic, and live both freely in a wide range of environments and also as parasites inside other organisms. And these things, they're just about everywhere. They've been found on the ocean floor. They've been found more than a mile underground. They've been found in extremely cold places, and they've been shown to withstand extreme heat, rivaling their distant and more famous cousins, the tardigrades. So it really wasn't surprising that when researchers went looking for nematodes in the rivers that feed the Great Salt Lake, they were easily able to find what they were looking for. In waters where the salt content was less than 1%, they found nematodes aplenty. But then the scientists got closer to the lake, and inside the lake, to waters that had 10% salinity and 11% and 14%. Very little else is known to survive in waters like this, because all that salt makes life very difficult. But in the waters just to the north of Antelope Island, the worms were doing just fine. And in fact, it appears that they had specifically evolved to live in a high salinity environment. They were, it appeared, either a completely new species or perhaps several new species. And to Julie Jung, this is important. Not just because she studies organisms that are able to live in extreme environments, but because she thinks it says something about the lake itself. Some people call the Great Salt Lake America's Dead Sea, but the lake isn't dead at all. And Jung says we can't keep treating it like it is. Jung is a postdoctoral research fellow based at the University of Utah, where she studies developmental plasticity and extremophile development. And she is the first author of a new paper on the identification of Great Salt Lake nematodes. Julie Jung, welcome.
Hi, Matthew. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Julie, among extremophiles, tardigrades get all the love and attention for being nature's badasses. Maybe rightfully so. I don't know. I really like those little guys. But help me make the case here for nematodes, because these are nature's other badasses.
I mean, not to say anything bad about tardigrades. We also found tardigrades in some of our Weber River, like, freshwater sites, and I was so, so excited to see the water bears. But yes, I do have a slight bias towards nematodes. My advisor, Michael Werner, really likes to say, if aliens ever, invade or find Earth, they'd be really interested in humans because of, all the influence that we've had on the planet, and but also nematodes, because they're the most abundant phylum of animal on the earth. Whenever I teach students, I love saying that by number, it's the most abundant. It's like 80%. So 4 out of 5 of every animal that there is on the earth is actually going to be a nematode. And it's amazing because most people don't even know what they are. I think I hardly knew what they are. I knew what C. elegans was because it's a model organism in biology, but
it's so famous in the aging space, right? C. elegans is where we got a lot of information about how organisms age.
Yeah, but I had no idea how many nematodes there were in just sort of any handful of dirt, even in our backyards, anywhere outside and on any of our in the water. I had no idea how prevalent they were.
But they are everywhere. But not as we knew it in the Great Salt Lake. But I want to go back to 2019, because this is when some researchers who were a research team that was led by Pei-Ying Shi in Paul Sternberg's lab at Caltech identified nematodes in a lake that is in many ways kind of a smaller version of the Great Salt Lake. Can you talk about Mono Lake, which is near Yosemite in California?
Yeah, so Lake Mono, this is really the paper that you're talking about is really the paper that sort of inspired us to look in the Great Salt Lake. There were other papers too. So there are nematodes had been found sort of miles underground under the Earth's surface in this dark South African gold mine, and that was in 2011. They've also been found in like some of the driest, coldest soils on Earth. A research station called McMurdo Dry Valley in Antarctica. So in 2019, a paper came out kind of considering nematodes found there. But also, we were really interested in Lake Mono. This paper in 2019, it's this sort of saline soda lake in California that's very arsenic rich, which we knew that the Great Salt Lake was also was very similar in a lot of respects. And so that team had discovered 8 new nematode species in that lake. So we thought, considering the super saline conditions of the Great Salt Lake, sort of the similar abiotic conditions found there, we predicted that maybe if we're lucky, we're going to be able to find some nematodes in our sort of neighboring Great Salt Lake.
And so you decide to go looking for these guys in the Great Salt Lake, and that's how you wound up spending a good deal of time in the spring, summer, fall in 2021 and the summer of 2022 in a kayak paddling around the Great Salt Lake. This seems like a great excuse for kayaking the Great Salt Lake.
It was so much fun. Yes. We found a lot of, actually it changed a lot. So we started off in kayaks, but sort of ended up, because of the rapidly changing lake elevations, we sort of hit this historic low in lake elevations. We started off in kayaks and paddle boards, but kind of ended up hiking, biking, wading, ATVing, sort of collecting all these sort of transport modes of transportation, just because we couldn't take our kayaks there anymore. So it was so much fun, though. It was very stinky, but we got used to it.
But you were going to the same location again and again, right? Throughout this period, sampling from the soil frequently across this period of 2 years.
Yeah, so we had 6 sampling sites. 3 of them were in the Great Salt Lake proper, sort of the tip of Fremont Island, to the southern tip of Fremont Island, the northern tip of Antelope Island, and then like a halfway point in between. So those were our 3 sort of very, very salty sites. And then we were also interested in getting a salinity gradient. So one of the inputs into the Great Salt Lake is the Weber River, which is freshwater. And so we tried to get 2 freshwater samples from the Weber River to kind of compare nematode populations, and then 1 brackish intermediate site somewhere in between.
And so you're chasing this gradient, and as you go, you're finding nematodes in the Weber River, and then in this delta area, this brackish area, and then in the Great Salt Lake. At each step of the way, you're finding these guys in increasingly harsh environments, at least in terms of the salinity of the water.
Yeah, we were really surprised actually to find nematodes in every site along this salinity gradient. Like a lot of nematodes in every site. And this is really kind of counter to what we found in Owens Lake, where there's this stark salinity gradient as the conditions of the lake got more salty. In Owens Lake, we found far fewer nematodes and even like basically no nematodes.
Yeah, talk about Owens Lake, because that's sort of the control arm of this. You're looking at Owens Lake, and you see that as it gets saltier, the nematodes just, it doesn't work out for them.
Yeah, so we were really interested in looking at Owens Lake. This is the one sort of near Los Angeles that's been getting a lot of press because it kind of completely dried out at some point towards the turn of the century, and that made a lot of people sick. So because it made a lot of people sick, there's this really large and expensive effort to restore the land. So in 2006, a dust mitigation project began. And so it's very convenient for us as researchers because now we have everything from hypersaline brine ponds, all the way to freshwater bird sanctuaries that team of people have put in, and these bird sanctuaries are kept full in order to keep birds and humans safe and happy and healthy. And so we have this really convenient salinity gradient across this lake as well. So we went and found a sort of similar to our Great Salt Lake, three freshwater sites with less than 1% salinity, to some really super salty sites, so up to like I think it was between 13 and 14%. And we looked for nematodes there, but really counter to what we found in the Great Salt Lake, we only found nematodes in our freshwater sites where the salinity was less than 1%.
Does that have anything to do with the fact that Owens Lake pretty much completely dried up at one point? And so a lot of these areas that you were sampling are newer in terms of having water again in them, or renewed, I suppose, as opposed to the Great Salt Lake, where even though it's been desiccating quite rapidly over the last decade and a half, two decades, it's never completely dried up.
I mean, it's hard to say exactly, but I think we're saying that it could be, or we're thinking that it could be because of this sort of time to rebound. But we also sort of a growing hypothesis amongst people in our lab. It's this really interesting question of like, why are there no nematodes in the high salinity sites in Owens Lake? We found way more nematodes in way saltier waters in the Great Salt Lake. And we actually think it's this association with microbialites, which we haven't really discussed yet, but one of the big findings in our paper is that we found that the nematodes really like the microbialites of the Great Salt Lake.
Yeah, you said they might be thriving on eating the bacteria.
So it's something about these sort of ancient microbial mounds that helps nematodes thrive in these hypersaline sites. So it could be that they're eating it, or that these little mounds are like protecting them from UV or from something else that's all these extreme environments.
You noted that they seem to be thriving in the even more exceptionally salty waters. You did your research on the south arm of the Great Salt Lake. The north arm is quite a bit saltier. Have you gone sampling there yet? Is it part of your exploration to see if, you know, in these waters that exceed sometimes 20-24% salinity, the nematodes can also survive there?
We did try. We tried really hard. And we're not the only ones that have tried. We collaborate with a researcher at BYU, Byron Adams. And so even before we looked in the south arm of the Great Salt Lake, he had gone to the north arm to look and didn't find any. And it could be just that we haven't looked in enough places. We did look though across that railroad track in a few of the sites and haven't really found any yet. It's just so surreal and extreme there. But yes, we did try. We tried our best.
So the ones you did find, you take them back to your lab. And you do a couple of things. You genetically sequence the nematodes themselves. You sequence the bacteria in their guts. And then you also did this really smart and simple thing where you put these guys, the ones that were found in the really salty water, you put them in fresh water and you watched to see how they responded.
Yeah, exactly. We wanted to see how adapted these nematodes are to super salty water, and also how they fare in fresh water. So just like typical, just plates. So just less salty conditions. And we found that they don't do very well. They don't do very well at all. So they
don't survive for even a few minutes, right?
No, we can kind of see them sort of shrivel up and and die pretty much. They don't survive very well at all on plates that usually like our lab nematodes thrive on.
Okay, scientist Julie Jung, I can hear this like emotional sadness in your voice right now where you're talking about these little tiny worms. You're a little bit distraught about this.
I watched a lot of nematodes die. Yeah, we looked at thousands.
But what this tells us is that these tiny little worms have evolved to specifically live in these high salinity conditions.
Yeah. A fun sort of comparison that we also conducted, like an experiment that we conducted, is that we took our common laboratory nematodes, so C. elegans, which we've mentioned before, and sort of a sister model species called Priscianchus pacificus. And so we took these laboratory nematodes, which do really well on non-salty agar plates, and we put them into Great Salt Lake water to see how they would do in about 14% salinity, and they also died pretty immediately. A fun thing, so we were kind of lamenting about the review process, but in the process of getting this paper accepted, and we had to have a lot of reviewers look at it, and one reviewer, it takes a long time, so we were, you know, at some point we were like, oh, kind of frustrated about it, but a really, really helpful reviewer comment suggested, why don't you put these laboratory nematodes onto plates that have been inoculated with microbialite bacteria and put them through the same survival assay but through a dilution series and see if they do any better. And we really thought this was like, oh, psh, this is kind of a waste of time. This is such a so low probability that they will actually, you know, that the bacteria that we can culture even are going to be the specific bacteria that help nematodes survive better. But we did a lot of experiments of these survival assays with C. elegans and P. pacificus, and we actually found that they do better when they're allowed to kind of eat this microbialite bacteria. And so that was pretty amazing to us.
You know, I think it's worth mentioning here that scientists tend to complain a lot about reviewers. But here is an instance, and there are many instances like this, in which the peer review process did very much what it was supposed to do. It improved the science.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this, Julie, tells us that we might be dealing with some new species of nematode, not just maybe ones that have kind of figured out how to work their way into the brackish and very saline waters of the Great Salt Lake, but they are fundamentally different enough that you may be putting some names on these things at some point, yeah?
Yeah, we hope so. We are working on it now. It's really like this kind of idea of what, you know, what even is a species. It's been really hard to kind of determine that. I think we find at least two, we're kind of calling them species groups. I know, I'm sure there's a better name for it, but we did, of all the nematodes that we found from the lake, there seem to be these two kind of groups that are emerging of Monasteridae, of this kind of marine nematode that we're mostly finding in the Great Salt Lake. And they're different based on where we found them. So there are some Monasteridae that are from freshwater sites, and a lot that are just from the salty sites. And so they're different kind of ecologically in where we found them, but also morphologically. There are the freshwater nematodes are kind of much smaller, and they have these like specialized mechanoreceptors called CD. They're like little kind of horns on their heads that are supposed to sense, to be mechanoreceptors, so they sense sort of vibrations in the water. And we see that in our freshwater samples, and we don't see them in our super salty samples. And so we think that, and these have a very low percent identity matches to other nematodes that are in online databases, genetic databases. So we think that there's at least some different species here. And so we're working with Byron Adams and his team at BYU to make a species description for these worms currently.
And that's a big effort, because there's like 250,000 subspecies or species of nematode, right?
Yes, there's a lot. I think it's so much fun. It's like this fun puzzle. We're just looking. So there are some kind of blurry pictures in this paper of our worms, because our microscope wasn't as good. So, but we found we're now using DIC and NCIC scope, and it's like just takes way better photos. And so I have this folder on my desktop that's like all caps, beautiful photos of worms.
And the cool thing is like, wow, we might have discovered this new species, but the larger picture here is that, as most school kids in Utah are taught, there are only two things that live in the waters of the Great Salt Lake. There's brine shrimp and brine flies. But maybe that's just for a lack of looking. You looked. You had a suspicion that you were going to find something. You looked for it. And you found not just one type of worm, but a lot of unique organisms that have evolved to live very happily in this very harsh condition.
Yeah. I also think that just kind of reminds me of these. I've been reading a lot about deep sea hydrothermal vents recently. A lot of this is because the kind of family of nematodes that we're finding in the Great Salt Lake is Monasteridae. It's one of the dominant fauna in the abyssal zone and in these like deep sea hydrothermal vents. And it's just this like, these are just these crazy sites of diversity and evolution that's happening, of like specific accelerated evolution that's happening in there. And there's just such interesting biology going on in these sites, where they're taking sulfate and making energy out of them. There's no light, so they're just finding these different ways. It's just this cool example of life finds a way. When I think about the nematodes that we've found in this like very extreme environment, I see a lot of potential in this system for helping us predict the boundaries of life on Earth. Over the past 10 years, scientists have discovered organisms living and thriving in places once considered extreme and uninhabitable, like permafrost and these deep sea hydrothermal vents and hypersaline lakes. We're kind of starting to explore these other worlds and finding more and more evidence for conditions that might support extremophiles. And so these sites can really help, like on our sort of research in these sites can really help trace the boundaries of life here on Earth. And it has really important implications for where complex life might be found elsewhere. So I think when I think about the nematodes that we found in our Great Salt Lake, that's sort of the potential that I'm seeing.
That's Julie Jung. She's a postdoctoral research fellow based at the University of Utah, where she studies developmental plasticity and extremophile development. And she's the first author of a new paper on the identification of nematodes in the Great Salt Lake. Julie Jung, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.